Welcome to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast series. Open House Melbourne acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was recorded. This podcast series explores themes or issues that act as catalysts for creative design thinking and clever design solutions. Each episode features a designer or creative in conversation with a client or field expert to unpack the topic through the lens of design and the built environment. This podcast was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. Some people may find the following conversation emotional as it deals with end-of-life care. I'm your host, Tanya Davidge, and in this episode, we're looking at the end of life as a catalyst for the design of palliative care facilities. What impact can good design have on spaces focused on the end of life? This catalyst conversation will consider the design of the places in which we might die and reflect on how we can live a good life right up until the end. It will look at what it means to die with dignity and address how we can help our loved ones to lead the conversation, allowing them agency at the end of life. Today we're speaking with Dr. Mark Bowie, the Director of Palliative Medicine at St. Vincent's Hospital, and architect and researcher Dr. Rebecca McLaughlin from the University of Sydney, to help us understand the important role design can play at the end of life. Mark, what do you do and how did you come to work in the field of palliative medicine?
Thank you, Tanya. I've been working in palliative care now for 35 years. I was drawn to it as a group of clinicians that seem to be very patient-centric, enjoy good communication and spending time talking to patients, and that sort of drew me in. What I've found over the years is I was the first palliative care physician at Royal Melbourne Hospital here in Melbourne, obviously, but also I was territory director in the Northern Territory of Palliative Care, so my sort of time has spread far and wide in many places around Australia as well as New Zealand, and then now more internationally with membership of International Collaborative for Best Care of the Dying. So feels like quite a bit of experience, but still very much grounded by clinical work and rural, regional and also hospital work, but particularly relevant today is in our new palliative care unit.
An incredible, I think, breadth of experience there, it sounds like. Could you talk a little bit about what palliative care is to give our audience a better understanding?
Yeah, so often when people think about palliative care, they almost immediately jump to the sense that it's all about end of life. Well, while that is an important pillar of the work that we do, and it's where we've sort of generated our specialty from, it's very much about the preparation. So when somebody's diagnosed or has advanced disease, people even think about the sort of possibility, probability or inevitability of dying. And in many ways, palliative care is the support glue that works with clinicians and others to really look at what that means to the person and understand where they're coming from, their anxieties, their stress, their relationship to considerations of death and dying, and sort of moving with them along the journey towards that inevitability of dying most often.
So there's a whole lot of supports then that palliative care provides, from, I suppose, physical to mental health.
Yeah. So it's very much around meeting the patient and family in their territory, hopefully, in their community, in their home. But if that's not possible, then we can move through outpatients, inpatient hospital considerations, but also specialist palliative care units. And the specialist palliative care unit has evolved in many ways. I often say we're like the ICU of palliative care, where the most complex problems tend to come, whether that's social problems, whether it's expectations of care, whether it's symptom management, or whether it's just by choice people don't particularly, for whatever reason, want to die in their own home setting.
And how long might somebody spend in palliative care?
Well, we often see nowadays that people can be in community-based palliative care for on an average of about 100 days. So often, and that can stretch out to 1, 2, 3 years sometimes. We often also see people in the outpatient environment as part of a team, say with the cancer doctors or with the chronic illness doctors, respiratory and so forth. We might see them for 4 or 5 years sometimes as part of the team membership, but the nitty-gritty of palliative care sort of usually kicks in the last 12 months of life.
Mm. I think that's, it's interesting for me to understand that personally. I think that's much longer than I had previously imagined it. I don't know what I had thought about palliative care before I met you. But
I think it's been an evolving specialty. We've just celebrated from a medical perspective our 30th anniversary of our specialty society. So we're relatively new, and there's really only about 600 medical practitioners in Australia and New Zealand to actually work in the field of palliative care.
Feels like we might need a few more. Rebecca, just want to throw to you now. I'm really interested a little bit in your background and the work you do as a researcher.
I'm an architect and an academic, and I think this is one of those situations where the research project found me. So about 12 years ago, I was working my PhD, and that was looking at psychiatric hospitals and how the built environment sort of impacts us as patients when we are feeling quite vulnerable. And at the same time, my mum essentially went into palliative care, although we weren't fully aware that was what was going on at the time. And so I found myself sort of sitting in a general hospital space and just seeing all the ways that it wasn't really good enough for that experience. And so that's kind of how I started working in this area. So my work looks at, I guess, what the emotional needs are when you are either and I'm going to say an end-of-life patient or the family member of, appreciating that a lot of this is respite care and symptom management as well. I guess my theory is if we can be designing to what you might consider the worst-case scenario, then the benefits for everyone else are there as well. So looking at, you know, how the environment sort of impacts the use of space, socialization between family members, perceptions of privacy, all of that sort of thing when you're an inpatient.
What do you think has driven the design of palliative care in the past?
Yeah, I think palliative care's got a really interesting history going quite a way back, which is not often talked about, of wanting spaces to be much more homely. So if, the work of Cecily Saunders, sort of I think in the 1960s, this theme has been going through the whole way. Where it comes unstuck, obviously, is that difference between what people would like those environments to be like and then what all the constraints of delivering a healthcare building are in terms of infection control and what materials you're allowed to use, the budgets you're having to work with, the limitations on how much space you're allowed to give to a particular unit, you know, and all the attendant things like, well, if we give palliative care more space, then the rest of the hospital is going to want more space. So it's this incredibly convoluted sort of system in which we're trying to carve out a different response for palliative care, but there's a lot of obstacles to doing that.
Mm, I think that's a really interesting observation. I would imagine that, you know, a lot of it's driven, or a lot of design and delivery is driven by efficiency and function in some ways. And, you know, as you mentioned, the space that your mother was in at the end of life wasn't really particularly functional for her needs or the family needs. What were some of those things that you thought about at that point in time that you thought needed to change?
Yeah, so I had a couple of pretty significant experiences, I suppose, in that first week that she was in the hospital. One was, there was this sort of bright orange seating alcove that when I first came across it, I was like, oh, that's great. Like, it's a bit of space that's not wholly functional, like that someone can take a moment in. And then a couple of days later, I saw a woman taking a moment in that space, and she was, look, I'm going to say it, probably more distressed than I've ever seen another human in my life. And I was just like, that's actually a really awful and just completely inadequate space for the experience that she's having in it. Another one, there was a young father on the same ward, and I sort of watched him stand in the corridor, and what I can only imagine from sort of watching 10 metres away was being told that it was the end, and just watching him sort of slump back against the wall because he couldn't sort of hold himself up in response to that news. And so it was really just the sense that these spaces just don't think about, like, the emotional toll, the emotional experience, just the real challenges that people are going through in them. And so that was kind of what was driving my research.
Well, those are really powerful
observations about, I think, how we support people and in the humanity of the moment. What are some of the things that your research tells us about the design of palliative care facilities?
Yeah, so for a while we've realised that, views to nature, good sunshine and daylight, being able to get out into gardens is important, and also that an environment appears more homely than institutional. But what the research tended to do was just accept those things without drilling down into why they were important and why they were important in the specific context of palliative care. So what we found out is, gardens are incredibly important spaces for people to spend time with family. So staff and patients and families are telling us, that's where they'll go to have a barbecue or a birthday party or to spend time with the grandkids, to meet with the dog. So if you don't have access to one of those spaces on the ward, then you're sort of cutting out the opportunity for all of those great things to happen, which are so important, both the end of life and if you're sort of in there for respite care when you'd rather be out doing other things. So again, things like privacy, yes, we all know privacy is important, but that's really thought about in terms of, well, a private room so that everyone else isn't overhearing, your medical conversations and what's going on. And when we actually talk to people, it's like, well, no, it's actually more the things like, I'd like to be able to talk to my partner about stuff that's going on without knowing that other patients, nurses and doctors can overhear me. I'd like to be able to have a private phone conversation. So there's all of these things that the research wasn't quite drilling down to why it was important.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I think it's such important research and work that's done. And I think what's really interesting about Mark's experience is he's got such an incredible and long-lived experience in this space, but he's also recently, worked to open a new space. So the Caritas Palliative Care Unit in Kew opened in September of 2022. The new facility has given St Vincent's an opportunity to incorporate elements into the design based on your years of experience. I was wondering if you can speak a little bit about what the old facility was like and what the new one is like now.
So the Caritas Christi site has been working as what you would call a palliative care unit, or originally a hospice, since 1938. So it's the second oldest one in Australia, the oldest being a comparable St Vincent's facility in Sydney, which was opened in 1896. So what that meant at that stage is obviously quite different to what it means now. It's gone through three rebuilds over that time on the site, and in many ways, the third rebuild, which is the current one, was generated because we recognised there was a need, not just us, but our organisation and our executives and so forth, recognised, really, very much like the research of Rebecca. I mean, that actually played an important role, I think, in understanding what was expected and what was hoped for to make a modern palliative care environment. Previously, the wards were relatively well set out, but again, and there was access to outside, but the rooms looked very sort of hospitalised. Climate wasn't necessarily under the control of the people that were in the room, so the ability to open windows and those sorts of things wasn't available. To get to the gardens, you had to sort of be either wheeled out or shown the way. It wasn't a direct route to the gardens from outside the rooms. Again, there were other things that just became old and tired. The nurses' stations were intrusive. The noise issues related to patients, conversations being overheard and those sorts of things. Just the general decor and the environment really didn't. It felt a little bit homely, but it wouldn't have been a home that most people would have called home if they had a choice to be there or not. Mm-hmm. So I guess all the elements that Rebecca's touched upon were recognised. And I think initially what started as a redesign of the lecture theatre and teaching environment became a project that encompasses the whole rebuild, and that decision-making process and completion took about 10 years to fruition.
Wow. I'm quite interested, I suppose, in some of these almost in-between spaces, some of the spaces I think Rebecca was talking about before. What are the spaces there at Caritas that you have?
So I think a few things. There are So again, space is there that people can find their own space. So access to most of the facility is relatively easy and straightforward. They can move very easily between their room and the outside space. They've got their own access in and out, as well as access to where the sort of more nursing, medical orientated bits and pieces are. Certainly if they are, often when they're having important conversations or needing to meet and get some critical news or difficult news or even just families meeting, there are plenty of spaces to go outside the room. So often when we have meetings with families, we try to use one of those. We've got three areas that people can go to which are dedicated to family meetings or patients and families getting together outside the actual room. We have a cafe area that's for patients. Also, people can come in, volunteers come in and cook there. That has access to an outside cafe area that's pleasant to be in. So again, it's giving elements that, I guess, if you're going to live towards the end of your life, you're there for respite or other things, you feel like you're actually living rather than just sitting there or lying in bed dying, if that makes us sounds yeah. an unusual thing. But the amenity is always something that people comment on, and often it's a public space, public facility, so people are often surprised that it's something that's been built within a sort of public health system. But we have plenty of other examples, like the Royal Children's Hospital and Peter MacCallum and other modern hospitals where design has been thought about. So it's nice now to have a palliative care unit that can meet some of those same standards.
Mm. It's an incredible facility. I was lucky enough to get a tour of it, and it's really impressive. And it feels very welcoming and warm, which I think was unexpected. It wasn't something that I was expecting. Rebecca, your research identifies some really important design considerations, and one of them is that design of these facilities includes semi-private space that's not the bedroom. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that, why that's important. I think we've already touched on it, but maybe a little bit more detail.
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, what we found is that it's one thing for a space to look homely, but when these facilities are really successful, it's when they allow those what I would call the routines of home to be enacted in the hospital. So, you know, things like having dinner with your family or playing with Lego with your grandchild. So I guess when you're talking about rituals of home and you start to think about it in that way, that idea comes up that you wouldn't walk into your neighbor's bedroom, and this is an idea Sarah McGann at Deakin's written, and greet them in their pajamas, right? Like, we would never do that. Yet we do it in a palliative care facility all the time, and we think nothing of it. So we looked at one facility in our study that had this little enclosed veranda space that was furnished like a lounge room. And the patients were saying to us, you know, they really like it because they can greet their visitors in that space. So they're not sort of feeling as exposed, as vulnerable. It's a more domestic setting. And I think that starts to speak to, I guess, the deeper interest of the study, which is, even though we might not realize it, I think the built environment impacts us in sometimes very subtle ways that might go over our head. So I had an experience recently where I wrote up four of the interviews we did with family members who recognized that their family member was nearing the end of life, right? So they were very cognizant that sort of this was where they were at. And it was quite a different experience to the patients and families we spoke to who were in palliative care units for respite or for symptom management. And when I wrote this up for a journal, one of the reviewers came back to me, and because I had also talked about my own experiences in that, she had said, I really want you to focus more and reflect on what those experiences meant for you, if you can. And it kind of triggered me to realize that when my mum was ill, she was in a 6-patient ward. So this was an old sort of 1950s hospital. It was an oncology unit. It wasn't a palliative care unit. And she was sort of surrounded by, you know, 6 other patients in various states of decline. My brother at the time was 22. So he was like young, fit, athletic, tanned, so out of place in that environment that it was actually really uncomfortable in ways I didn't quite appreciate why at the time. And we sort of encouraged him to keep going to work. And part of that was because it was almost bleaker when he was there, you know, like it was such a sharp relief to every other person in that room that it was somehow more difficult if he was around. And so, you know, at the time we thought we were doing him a favor, you know, like you don't want to sit on this, you know, depressing ward all day, go to work. In retrospect, you know, we didn't really realize how close my mum was to the end. So we weren't doing him a favor at all. And so it really is, I think, those subtle ways that the environment can impact you that if you're not an architect, you never think about. And even if you are an architect, you still might not realize till, you know, 12 years later.
Mm. And so there are these other spaces that you can design into these types of facilities that would actually make everybody feel welcome, not just the person who's near the end of life, but also different members of their families at different stages of their lives. So children, for example, you know, yeah, right through to kind of, I suppose, young 20-year-old fit blokes.
Yeah. I mean, even things like carpet, it sounds like such a simple thing, but it's so difficult to get across the line in these projects. And what we've heard from sort of multiple facilities around the world is that if you put carpet in a room, kids will sit and play, right? And they'll be quite happy to sit in that hospital room and play self-entertained for quite some time, as opposed to, you know, being bored and needing to be taken out to the garden or the playground every 5 minutes. So we can do these really subtle things and they can actually have quite a big impact.
Mm. And Mark, I mean, Caritas has a lot of these types of spaces.
The cafe area and the outside courtyards lead into in and out of the cafe. We've got the sort of art room, which is open, and you often find after hours that people come in there and you can see kids writing things on the table and they draw and people just use it instinctively. It's a sort of inviting space. Certainly outside they can do whatever they like when they go outside, you know. So we're lucky that they don't feel enclosed by the rooms that they live in. And we've also then got sort of hallways that lead to other bigger spaces, small meeting rooms if need be, and also a chapel, which is sort of, you know, remnants of the past where they've drawn elements of the old convent that used to be on site there as part of the structure, but it's actually a very modern design and people go there for sort of quieter contemplation, I guess, and can be away from the ward completely if need be. So,
have you been surprised at the ways in which people have been using the new facility?
Yeah, I think so. I guess I've always seen the benefits, and I think the surprise is that people are surprised that it's a facility that's there for anyone who comes in to be there. It's not something that's exclusive, say, to private patients or to others. I think families are surprised at times that it's just such a welcoming environment because they're not used to these sorts of environments, and particularly they've come, although from residential aged care or somewhere where, you know, even though there is a lot more effort in design nowadays, often that's fairly lacking. So again, those sorts of changes, it just makes people relax. The green spaces, as mentioned before, as soon as people see green, even if it's a few pot plants sitting outside their room, they always make a comment as soon as they go in the room that that we haven't seen an outside space for sometimes weeks when they've been in one of the hospitals and their treatment's been taking a while to sort out and so forth. So, yeah. And I think one of the other things that I think is one of the biggest surprises, which sounds very basic, but it's on the ground. So people aren't having to ask others to go up and down an elevator, find their way outside. So access is, they're on the ground, they sort of feel part of the ground. And that's particularly important, well, I think for everybody, but particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who, you know, can be, you know, elevation up a number of floors can be a little bit detrimental to their sense of place. And so seeing symbols that you may not recognise, but we have certain plantings, that, you know, like salt bush and other sort of grasses that symbolise the connections to the Yarra, That's only about a 10-minute walk down the road. There's sort of borrowed environment of all the trees in the parks nearby. So, you know, there's a whole lot of things that sort of have been surprising about it. But for us, it's great as well because the staff are also well catered for. So not only focusing on patient spaces to cater for their needs, but the staff rooms and staff amenities kind of shows that they're valued and not devalued. Often, you know, staff are cluttered into very cramped spaces and small offices and there's no room to interact with each other without feeling like you're treading all over everybody if you go into older hospitals and places. But there's a big open multidisciplinary space. There's staff amenities for cycling and showering and things that we'd never had in the previous buildings or iterations. Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because we can often make do when we work in certain types of places and types of buildings. We can often make do and still do a fantastic job. But, you know, the building might be working against us. And I think there's some really interesting stuff in the work that you've done, Rebecca, around understanding, I suppose, the importance of also designing for staff members and employees. What does that, what do you feel that good design, how do you feel good design can help in that situation?
Yeah, so we've done a lot of work where we've had palliative care professionals come in and talk to students about what they need. And a lot of projects, not just in palliative care, but across healthcare, where we ask staff what they need. And a lot of the time, they will put the patients first. So they will ask for things that they know the patients need. And if there are budget cuts, they will prioritise what the patient needs. And whilst that's really admirable, I think we often forget how hard these jobs are. So, you know, it's incredibly difficult to lose patients. And particularly in palliative care, where you know a lot of the time that is what the outcome's going to be, right? You're not... it's not heart surgery where you're performing these life-saving operations and then everyone's high-fiving you afterwards. So I do feel like those spaces that just give some space for staff to sort of to have those feelings, to have that moment alone, to get out of all the, I don't think chaos is the word, but I guess the emotional burden of what they're in the middle of. And we've done work at children's hospices as well. And so it really kind of hits home to me just how much, you know, some daylight, some private space, a little bit of green space, just the chance to get out of it all for a minute can really help staff.
Mm. And how have your staff taken to the new facility?
Oh, good. Well, often people who walk towards palliative care as clinicians do it by choice. You know, people aren't sort of cajoled into it. So it's a job that they enjoy doing from a clinical perspective. But I think they've really enjoyed and embraced it. We did lose significant garden when it was rebuilt just by the nature of having to build an underground car park and a whole lot of things. But it seems to be that it's a place where people really seem to enjoy coming to work and being at work. And I think proud to show people around and welcome patients rather than sort of feeling like it's all a bit dim and dusty and old and those sorts of things. So I think that's fantastic, I think. The other thing that's important, of course, is that the spaces that we use for meetings and teleconferences and all those sorts of things are separate from the patient environment, so we're not having to share spaces. So I think that's been critical. And even though, as Rebecca's mentioned, sometimes you get cutbacks and there's budget overblows and things get reimagined, it hasn't impacted too greatly on that separation from patient and families to the staff areas.
I mean, it's actually quite incredible talking to people in this space. There's such an incredible understanding, I think, of humanity. And so it's really nice to see that design can support the people who care and who are working in these spaces and get to know a little bit more about the role that design has to play in that, because it's obviously not the be-all and end-all, but it is an incredibly difficult job. And as you said, these, you know, your staff members have chosen to work in this space for a reason.
No, I often do say that palliative care brings the humanity back into healthcare. And sometimes that sort of gets a bit of a cheer from the audience sometimes when people are sort of being cajoled through there, which would be their normal sort of medical care. But yeah, I think those elements need to be there across healthcare, but it's important, particularly at end of life. Yeah.
What are some of the barriers to really providing the best palliative care and best designed palliative care facilities that we can?
So my current project is looking at this whole idea of barriers because they are myriad. A lot of it's in the procurement process. A lot of it's in the multiple stakeholders. To a degree, it's budgets. But look, I think sometimes there's a fear of innovation. Sometimes there's a concern about doing things differently. Sometimes it's about not wanting to have to buy different cleaning products because, you know, one part of the hospital has a different floor to the rest of it. None of it is insurmountable, but it seems to be. So I think this is sort of a global question that people have been trying to figure out for years, and I don't have the answer for you yet, except to say that there's a lot that needs to be overcome.
What are the barriers, Mark, that you might have encountered in your thinking and that you've had rethink?
I think we were lucky because our organisation underwrote the funding of the facility, recognising it's both a public and private facility, but it didn't rely on government funding. But we have to meet all the same rules and regulations of sort of government funding, regulations for, amenity and things that are provided to provide healthcare and make sure that we've got the right resuscitation bits and pieces and all those sorts of things. But they can be hidden away in patients' rooms so they're not so obvious and things like that. But so one of the barriers, I think, even though funding is always important, that having freedom to do what they wanted to do with the architects rather than feeling that there was somebody looking over their shoulder being a bit more critical about specifications and things. I do think infection control, which was mentioned up front, can have an undue influence and impact because their thinking is all about regulation and hospital compliance and that can, if you haven't got somebody that's a bit switched on to why design is important, it can affect the choice if you don't have strong advocacy. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is we engage the staff that are actually going to work there as part of the process. So they were able to critique at various stages what was being thought about in terms of what was going to be utilised in the facility. But particularly when we got to the patient room design, some of our nursing and occupational therapy staff picked up things that hadn't been picked up. So we were able to make changes as the process evolved.
I would 100% agree with everything Mark just said. They do tend to be the strategies that we see that enable these more successful facilities to be built. But I suppose what was driving my project and what I think is still the big problem is that we know architects can do really great standalone hospices. Like we see it all over the place, and Caritas Christi is one of those great examples. But when you try and shift that thinking into a general hospital environment, that's when all those pieces start to come unstuck. So what we're trying to look at now is, how do you keep those pieces in place through those complex procurement programs so that you can still enjoy them when the building's done?
I would agree with that as well. If people have seen the modern Peter MacCallum Cancer Institute in Melbourne, it looks glorious when you go in there. I always call it the Melbourne's Guggenheim, but the ward spaces are very similar to usual hospital wards, yeah. Whereas mental health now in Victoria, and I'm sure elsewhere, is experimenting with mental health pods in ED, which is separate, and they're sort of calming spaces that are quite different to the rest of the ED for mental health patients. And that's an initiative of state government to do that. So people are, in some areas, most critical people are thinking about these things, but translating it into actual practice is the hard part.
You're changing culture, right? The culture of a way a system works. And it does feel like in lots of health scenarios there has been a huge shift in the past 10 to 15 years, but obviously there's still much more work we can do.
Yeah, well, so one of the questions that I got a lot is, do you know, do family needs for these environments differ greatly from patient needs, right? Because for the most part, patients are very grateful to be getting good care and they're not going to complain about the environment they're in. They're kind of fine with it. Families seem to have a higher degree of need. And then when you looked at families who are experiencing end-of-life care, that need kind of rocketed up again. And so what we saw with those people is really a desire that the environment would sort of reflect back to them the gravity of the situation they're in. You know, like they are about to lose the person they love and they feel like they are in a hospital room that looks like any other hospital room in the building. And that seemed to be a point of, I guess, discomfort, that they felt like there wasn't enough gravity given by the architecture to what they were going through. And I thought that was a really interesting finding.
That's really fascinating. I mean, I remember when my grandmother passed away and my kids were really young, or my daughter, she must have been about 18 months old, 2 years old, and I didn't feel comfortable taking her into that space, but I wanted her to kind of know her grandmother because my grandmother was really important to me. So it's so wonderful, I suppose, to hear about the kind of spaces that we can have nowadays. I feel like, you know, when we visited Caritas, it would be a space that I would feel comfortable taking my daughter because, you know, like I think grief is not only for one type of person, or saying goodbye to somebody is actually not only for, you know, a son or a daughter or a very close family, you know, it's for all of the family and everybody that we can think of.
One of the interesting things is we often have architect students from coming and engaging, and they're obviously given design briefs or they're given projects to do, and they often want to put, you know, palliative care units out on a cliff somewhere overlooking the sea with no connection to the landscape, but no connection to anything else to do with healthcare. And that's problematic because dying is relatively complex nowadays. It's not the simple thing that it used to be because now we have so many people with so many longer trajectories leading towards that time. And so we still need to be connected in some shape or form to healthcare, and the ability to still look and investigate, if need be, around, you know, the usual things that we would normally do. So, again, that's very hidden at Caritas, and we're able to do it, and we're able to facilitate between our different facilities, if need be. But the other important factor, which, again, is very hidden but becomes very apparent to families in particular, is the quality of food that's provided if they're on site. So we're lucky. We do have our own, because we have an aged care facility built on site as well, we have our own chefs and cooking food team, which provides exceptional food, which is remarkable because we have to sit down once a month and road test the food. But it is a big hidden thing, but it's one thing that families judge places on, is the quality of food that's provided not only to the patient but to themselves as well and staff. You know, we have access to a small restaurant next door, which again we can utilize and our patients can utilize as well. So you don't have to just eat in your room, you can eat in their small cafe restaurant next door as well. So
yeah, this came up a lot in our research too. And so the addition of fridges into patient rooms was a huge thing in terms of, you know, like it's not an expensive thing to do. It doesn't take up a lot of room. But families would say to us, you know, my partner only wants to drink orange juice at this point in time. So if I can bring fresh orange juice, then I feel like I'm doing something for them. And one of the positive changes we are seeing come out of the research is this greater recognition of kitchens, even in general hospital settings. So the fact that people do want to be able to sit down as a family when they can, they do want to be able to cook their own food. And so we're starting to see some of that thinking filter into general hospital spaces, which is quite a relief.
Yeah. So if I think of ours, I think we've got four kitchens that are available to the public space, various points. Again, they're not obvious to everybody and we show them, but there are four kitchens that people can use. We've got two others that are only for staff, but it's an interesting point. So
fantastic. I mean, isn't it interesting the way, I suppose, when you start to think about the end of life, how we focus on the importance of little things and we value the everyday, that social space of sharing a meal or just enjoying a meal is really incredible. And I think this is possibly brings us back to Rebecca's research around homeliness and so what makes a space homely? And it's, I imagine it's not the same for everybody. And how do you deal with that?
No, but I think when you think of homely as an aesthetic, it's not the same. But when you think of it as a set of practices that you might like to do, then there are a lot more commonalities. And then if you try to go a step further and say, well, let's think about this in terms of a number of flexible or building flexibility to accommodate different practices, then I think you start to hit the mark with what we want to do.
I think often when people are unwell, you might hear people say, oh, they want to go home. But often it's what home represents, and that's an interesting concept to talk to healthcare professionals and nurses and at family meetings, that often that request to be at home is what it represents. It could be a quiet space, it could be a certain way of feeling, or as Rebecca mentioned, having access to things that maybe they would normally have access to and so forth. I think ultimately I would say, and I often say this, is that people want to feel a sense of safety, and safety in the broadest context, not just, you know, say physical safety from people breaking in sort of thing, but I think safety in the sense that they feel that there's a freedom to express themselves, to be able to talk freely, to maybe enact their own cultural practices or speak about their faith in a way they're not going to be judged or... and I think for individuals, they want to be feeling safe so they can be heard, they can feel valued, they feel understood. And I think if it is ultimately looking at dying, I think there is a sense that sort of dying folds around the patient. And I think people might call that letting go, but I think that's what the environment helps. And that's why home, country, being back in community is so important, because it's what it represents to that person to feel safe.
Do people bring things in?
Yeah, certainly.
Them?
And I certainly not some people, extravagant to the extreme, and you know, you can have sort of art and decoration and wall hangings, and but often it's more momentums. It might be flowers from the garden, it might be photos. You know, pets visiting, that sort of thing. I make sure that we acknowledge photos. So if people have brought photos in, I like to ask and talk about the photos, often before you talk about the sort of things that medical and nursing people like to talk about, but because that's important to them. And the pin boards or the boards are quite near the bed. So, because often I used to think, isn't it odd, they've brought the family photos in, but the poor person who wants to look at them, they can be about, you know, 3 or 4 metres away from the bed. So it's really for our entertainment rather than their comfort. But simple things like that. But, you know, people ask and do what they need to do for themselves, I think. The only restriction is we have to, again, get, you know, there are electrical devices and things. We have to get the checker to come and check them. So there are, that's a small barrier at times, but not an insurmountable barrier, that we have to make sure there's compliance issues with sort of electrical equipment and things. So, yeah.
And so that's, yeah, that's just one of the processes and ways of working that you deal with to enable a sense of a home or making people feel comfortable and safe in that space. So it's just a different way of thinking about how you manage that. What are some of the I suppose items and objects that make people feel at home that you've seen, Rebecca?
Yeah, I saw the most incredible hospital room, where there was literally not a surface of hospital left. So this family had brought in side tables, fairy lights, pictures. There were rugs on every chair. There were rugs on the bed. And I think it was as much for their loved one as it was for them, you know, just to take the starkness off that situation. And it was absolutely beautiful. But at the other end of the spectrum, you know, I spoke to a patient who I asked them the question, do you miss anything from home? And he was like, oh, I really miss my transistor radio. And I was like, well, we could just tell the nurses. They'll arrange to have that brought in for you. And he was like, no, because then I'm admitting I'm here for good. And so there's always this very strange, you know, balancing act that I think people sort of walk between how much they want to be there or don't. And so, again, I think it comes back to that flexibility, right? Providing a space that allows all of those people to do as they want to do, and doesn't assume a bunch of things on the part of patients.
Yeah. And this goes, I suppose, to agency. And what you were talking about before is that actually we need to talk to people about what they want and different things work for different people.
Yeah, and give them a sense that we are open to be open, I guess, to any of their thoughts and discussions. We're not there to sort of be... We are a healthcare facility, but we're not there to be like a hospital. We are to be what a palliative care unit should be, you know, which I think is great. And we have a lot of people coming to visit us just to see what it is that we've done. But ultimately, it is about the things that Rebecca has talked about as well, you know, and it's just opening people's eyes to some common ways of creating that sort of environment, I think, that but having good intention rather than we're not just reacting to people criticising, there's intention to make it a good facility. It's always been there in the design and the panelling that's used, which is comforting. It looks like modern homes. It's got a very sort of mid-century modern aesthetic, you know, and there's a neutralness to some of the patterning and the tones means that it will maybe have longevity, but it allows people to bring their own touches without feeling like it's going to be a clash or something, or we're going to, a lot of the iconography that people use, you know, some because it's a Catholic facility, people are worried that the iconography might be a bit traumatizing, so it's removable. And that's explained to people if indeed they notice it.
Yeah.
So all those sorts of things, you know, are there. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a pretty amazing facility. And I think what's really interesting is we often have preconceived notions about what these spaces are, like how we almost have to live out the last parts of our life. But what I found really empowering about our conversation and the both of your work is to really understand that if we just think differently about these things and actually center people's experience, you know, and what they might want from the end of their lives or those last kind of moments or days, we can actually think much more deeply about how we more fully support a person, essentially.
Well, I think we talk a lot about we are person-centred care, and I think in many we are. That's what's attractive for people who work, and that we really focus on the world from the patient's perspective and the family's perspective. And as I try to sort of teach our medical students and others and younger doctors, is you've really just got to think about if you were sitting in that bed or you were trying to get up out of that chair, what would you want and see? And so I think, you know, you're either somebody who's already in that place of being patient-centred. For some people, that's just not part of their sort of personality makeup and as a clinician, and it may not be, you know, for their medical career or their nursing career, so they pick a different place to be. And we don't go for adrenaline, we go for aesthetics. So it could be anaesthetics or aesthetics, but we go for aesthetics. So, yep.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's the question of that value system, and that's what we've been trying to do through our work is, you know, because obviously the medical space is patient-centred, but procurement processes are not. So how do we get people to not think about, you know, to think as much about the impact on the patient as they do about the impact on the budget and a building project?
Mm, and then, you know, what are some of the small things you can do?
Yeah.
That, you know, might just be a simple change in process of the way you work, but that can really enable big impacts on that patient end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Well, I think grounded in Melbourne, whenever there's a football event on, the staff get all geared up for it, and so the patients will often be geared up for it. And that's often somebody's last wish, is to watch their last AFL game, or and because the televisions can pull out from the wall and they can get up close and personal to the football event, you know. So there is avenues to get that. They don't have to go out to a special room, or they can if they want to. But there are those sorts of event things. But, you know, often there are things that families are celebrating, and it can be from weddings and celebrations of different life events that we can facilitate, and right through to just sort of intimate moments, organising a dinner in one of the other spaces, you know, those sorts of things, you know.
I think what's really interesting to me is we often think of kind of the things that build community and strengthen community bonds as celebratory, right? You know, we go to a multicultural festival, or we do, you know, different bits and pieces. But I think, you know, thinking about this space at the end of life, there's also this incredible amount of community that can be built around just the small connections in some ways, like that strengthening of family connection, the idea of legacy, you know, what you're leaving behind, you know, who your family is, those moments of small connection.
And we have those. We have people that can do biography with people. So people have, you know, once they feel safe and people are going to actually listen to them, they will start to talk about their lives. And everyone's got unique lives, and everyone's got unique perspective on that life, and often it comes from places of sort of great surprise. You know, we get people who've been, say, prisoners, you know, disadvantaged people all their lives, who've done difficult and bad stuff. Not that we necessarily get to hear their story about that, but they can still be very reflective and insightful and creative, and we provide that outlet. We had a Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander gentleman, and he was the most insightful person who could self-reflect, and he was having traumatic nightmares and all sorts of things, but he could weave that into the story of his creation story and his sort of dreaming, and saw it as just part of the transition to dying. So in many ways he became a great teacher. He was with us for about 3 months, and he really taught our staff a lot about his Aboriginality, and the past of all the difficult and bad stuff he did didn't really figure in his end-of-life story. So it was great to be able to tell family that, who couldn't be there because of other health issues, and he was distant from them. But you could see that's a benefit that you would never replicate in just an ordinary hospital environment.
No. Absolutely not. We're kind of coming to the end of our conversation, which is a bit of a shame because I could sit here and talk to you both all day. In terms of, I suppose, a bit of a last question, I'm really interested from both of your perspectives to understand how you'd like to see the design of palliative care spaces evolve. What does the ideal palliative care space look like into the future for you both?
Look, I've already seen some. There's some amazing things on the drawing board that I'm not allowed to talk about, but I've been privy to. And they do all of the things that we talked about in our research. So what will be interesting is to see how those designs travel through the procurement process and how much of them gets built the way the architects want them to be. But it's some pretty forward-thinking, amazing stuff.
So we'll have to come back to you once they're open and ask you about them.
Indeed.
Is that that? And Mark, from your perspective?
I think, well, in many ways, I think we had such an engaged group, St. Vincent Self Australia CEO, in the process from top down, but also bottom up. There was this sort of connection and understanding of what they were trying to achieve. And I think that vision and certainly the work of Rebecca and others has impacted on that. So taking it seriously enough to consider it, and then obviously to meet the architects that can hopefully, you know, create the vision and then engage staff and patients along the way to kind of implement the vision, I guess, in a way that's actually useful and capable. Yeah, but I think it is all about patients and their families finding that sense of safety to be themselves so they can We sort out the symptoms and the difficult stuff so they can be themselves and they can, you know, get that chance to really hopefully be honest about what they need to say before they die and be honest about who they are. And we understand that. We see them as the person they were, not the person that they think they've become because of illness and so forth.
Mm. Well, I'd like to thank you both for speaking with me today. It's been a really fantastic conversation. I think what's also a key takeaway for me is the more we see people with a vision and people aspire to build better places and facilities and to understand what that means, it just raises the benchmark on the future provision of these types of facilities. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next and the design of these spaces. So thank you, Mark, and thank you, Rebecca. That's great.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast. Open House Melbourne delivers Australia's largest architecture and built environment festival and year-round programming that connects people to place and builds public understanding of good design, inspiring people to explore, celebrate, and care for their cities, suburbs, and regions. Open House Melbourne's Catalyst podcast series was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. This series is recorded at The Push in Collingwood Yard, a youth music organisation and charity with the purpose of giving every young person the opportunity to participate and thrive in Australian music. Find out more about The Push at thepush.com.au.